Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin have written a book called Rest in Power, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin, about their relationship with their son, his death, the court case, and his legacy. It's published by Spiegel & Grau, and I'm very pleased it has brought Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin to our show today. Hello.
Hello. How are you?
Good morning.
Did you feel that there was a story to be told that hadn't been told in all of the news coverage? Is that one of the reasons you wrote this book?
We basically felt that the news just did like headlines and like a quick summary. And so we wanted to give our account of what we experienced as parents of Trayvon Martin. We feel like we were the best persons to speak for him since he's not here. And so who better than his parents?
How old would he be today?
He'd be
22 on February 5th.
February 5th, yes.
And you've chosen to tell this story in alternating chapters, each of you writing a chapter?
Yes, because we felt like if it was a book all about me or all about Tracy, instead we decided to write alternating chapters so that the reader could see both parents' side of view.
I thought it was because you divorced some years ago. Sabrina, you've said that your name has been both a blessing and a curse. In what way?
Because every time I tell people my name, Sabrina, they always spell it S-A-B-R-I-N-A.
And it's spelled S-Y-B.
It's spelled S-Y, so it's different. I feel like I'm different because I'm a blessing.
Now, is that one of the reasons you chose to name your son Trayvon?
No, I think that was just particularly. I didn't want to have a junior, but I wanted his name to be kind of close to my name, and so that's why we chose Trayvon.
Instead of Tracy.
Yes.
You were born in Miami, but raised in East St. Louis?
Correct.
What was life like there? The East St. Louis is a largely African-American town.
Correct. Life growing up, it was good. It was good. It was 99.9% African-American. And growing up was tough there. I grew up in a single-parent home. But my mom worked several jobs to provide for me and my brothers. And she taught us, she instilled some great values in us as young men. And
did she give you the talk?
Oh, she always gave us the talk.
About racism?
About racism, because we had surrounding cities around East St. Louis that were predominantly white. And, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, racism was still alive and showing. And so by being from East St. Louis, we used to be in certain areas, and we would get called out our names and even chased at times.
And you gave Trayvon that speech?
Correct. We just let him know, and not saying that Trayvon grew up in that same era, whereas he would get chased in his own neighborhood, but just knowing that what we had been through as young men, young African-American men, that it would be a possibility that that could happen.
Sabrina, you write that Trayvon was a mama's boy.
Absolutely.
In what way?
He was so close to me. We were very close. You know, you have little girls that are daddy's girls, and then you have boys that are mama's boys. So my boys are definitely mama's boys.
He went to a couple of different high schools. Why did he transfer?
Well, I transferred him from one school to another school. Even though he liked Miami Carroll City, I transferred him to Dr. Michael Kropp because I thought it was a better school. And they gave schools grades at that time, and Dr. Kropp got a better grade. And so I just felt like he needed a change. He was transitioning from kind of the little boy to the kind of a teenager, and I just thought that he needed a change, and I changed the schools.
And you say the problem started to arise at the start of his 11th grade school year.
Correct.
That's what was happening.
That was right when I changed the school. Mm-hmm. At the other school, he was there with a lot of his friends and everything. And so I know there was an adjustment where he had to make new friends. I know that. And because he would tell me he didn't know that many people there. And I'm like, you know, you can make friends. I mean, he was a friendly person. He was a people person. So I just felt like he could make new friends. And eventually he did, you know, some good friends, some bad friends. But, you know, nevertheless,
high school is.
Right, right. He had to pick and choose and decide which ones were going to be, you know, beneficial for him. So I changed schools because I felt it was a better school.
Tracy, are you tired of telling the story about how he saved your life from an accident in your
car?
No,
you know, as a father, you never get tired of telling that story. That's something because that's definitely a proud moment that I remember from him. And the sad part about it is that I wasn't there to save his life. And so I never get tired of telling that story because it just reminds me that, you know, how grounded we are in this fight for him. And so as long, you know.
There was a fire and he pretty much saved your life.
Yeah, he pretty much, unable to get out of the fire because of the grease had burned my lower extremities. And I called and called him and called him, and he finally woke up. And he pulled me out of the kitchen and went back in and retrieved a phone and called 911. And that just showed who he was as a child.
And how are you? Have you recovered completely from the burns?
Yes, I've recovered here before.
My guests are Tracy Martin and Sabrina Fulton, the parents of Trayvon Martin. They have co-authored a book called Rest in Power, A Parent's Story of Love and Justice and the Birth of a Movement. Why Rest in Power?
I think that it speaks for itself, that we know that Trayvon is resting in peace, but look at everything that's going on behind his name. Look at his legacy. Look at the movements that his name has sparked. And so it's a lot of power behind Trayvon's death. And it's a fight. It's a fight for justice. And so Rest in Power is definitely a name that we feel proud of.
Now, why do you think that the reaction to what happened here was more powerful than similar incidents in the past?
I think people were just a little sick and tired. I believe that since Emmett Till and maybe before some others, that people just continued to hear about African-American young men and women being shot and killed, and nobody does anything about it. And I think when this happened with Trayvon, I think that was the last straw for a lot of people. And instead of just complaining about it, they wanted to do something about it. And so I think that's why so many people, you know, they just could not understand, just like we couldn't understand why you had a 17-year-old that was unarmed. You had a 28-year-old man with a loaded gun. How could that possibly be any comparison? And so I think that's the reason why so many people were involved. They were just sick and tired of the same thing continuing to happen, and that's why they came out to rallies and protests, and so many people got involved.
Tracy, why did Trayvon come to visit you on that week in February?
Well, he wasn't visiting me. I live in Miami.
The two homes at different times?
No, he was living with Sabrina, actually. Mm-hmm. And of course, he had the luxury of spending time with either of us anytime he wanted to. But at the time, he had been suspended for school. And so I was going to Orlando that weekend, and I wanted him to just, as you know, I didn't want him to sit at home. My friend was living in Orlando at the time, and so we decided to send Trayvon up to, you know, he was out of school. We didn't want him to just be sitting at home doing nothing.
And then he wasn't there. He could have just been out. When did you realize that this was going to be a serious problem? Did you think about filing a missing persons report?
Well, he had not just been. I mean, he was up there more than one day. He was up there for he had been up there for almost 3 or 4 days at the time that this incident happened, and so that Saturday night when we last spoke, he called and asked. I called and asked him, did he have enough money to get him some pizza. And he had enough money, and so when we returned to the home Saturday night, Trayvon wasn't there. Sunday night, Trayvon wasn't there, and so I made a few phone calls, and his phone kept going to voicemail. I called my nephew's phone; it was going to voicemail. So I thought they were in the movies, because that was a plan that they had early in the day, and so it got late, and I laid down. And when I woke up, I searched for him, and he still wasn't there. So that's when I started calling the emergency numbers, trying to find him.
And when the police told you what happened to your son, you say that you knew the killer wasn't black. Why?
I didn't reference that the killer wasn't black. I know who the killer was at that time.
They already told you that it was George Zimmerman.
No, they hadn't told me at that time. What was told to me was that it had been an incident which occurred, and the individual was a white Hispanic male, and they didn't know what the particulars of the incident.
Sabrina, what were you doing when you learned what had happened to your son?
I was at work, and when Tracy initially called me and told me that something had happened, but he didn't know what it was, and so I left work and went downstairs, and I was in my car when he actually called back to tell me what the detective had said.
And then later on, you said that you found strength in the lyrics of a song that was made famous by the Mississippi Mass Choir, Your Grace and Mercy.
Yes.
So that was the lyrics of a gospel song come to you in moments of stress?
Well, I needed something. I was by myself, and I needed something, and that's all I could think of.
You and Tracy identified Trayvon at the police station, but why hadn't the police taken George Zimmerman into custody yet? Why wasn't he arrested, although he had admitted to having killed Trayvon?
Well, I initially identified Trayvon through photos at the house, and later on we went to the police department just to, find out what happened. And so that whole day, we were told, after I identified him, they say that they were going to send the information over to the medical examiner's office in Volusia County. And so I just wanted to, it was strange to me, Volusia County, that the detective decided to drive the information over to Volusia County when he could have easily just faxed the information over. And so I thought that was kind of strange. And
did you ever find out why that was?
I really didn't find out where it was. And there really wasn't a reason for him to drive that information 45 minutes away when he could have easily just faxed it.
My guests are Tracy Martin and Sabrina Fulton, co-authors of Rest in Power, A Parent's Story of Love and Justice and the Birth of a Movement, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin. It is published by Spiegel & Grau. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin, who have co-authored a book about their son called Rest in Power, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin. It is published by Spiegel & Grau. Tracy, you say that your lawyer, Benjamin Crump, had trouble getting the police to release the tapes of the 911 phone calls on February 26th. Why was that?
I think they were just trying. They didn't want the 911 tapes released because they didn't, it wasn't collaborating with the story that they were giving us, that the police department was giving us. It just didn't add up. And so we had to actually file a lawsuit against the city of Sanford to get the tapes released.
Did you have the feeling they were protecting George Zimmerman?
Yes, definitely. We felt from the beginning that they were trying to protect the killer of our son. And it was stated at night that the detective had some type of contact with the state attorney as well as the killer of our son's father.
You mentioned that you didn't want the Trayvon's death to be a race issue. How did you want it to be perceived?
Well, we just wanted it to be perceived as an issue, an injustice issue, a wrong issue. And initially, we continued to say that this wasn't about race. It wasn't about black and white. It was about right and wrong. But the longer the story played out, the more it became evident that race was an issue.
Well, the way the Sanford police were relating to you, the withholding information, for example, about George Zimmerman having a police record, wouldn't that suggest that there was a racial component in it?
Yeah, I thought it was. At first, they initially said that the individual had no record, that his record was squeaky clean, and then just to find out through a news source that he had multiple incidents and run-ins with the law. I think that was a part of deception that played a part, a huge part.
Now, who's Kevin Cunningham, and what role did he play in pushing for the arrest of George Zimmerman?
I think Kevin Cunningham was the young man that started
Change.org.
He's the young man that started Change.org, the online petition to get the individual responsible for our son's death arrested.
And then the two of you decided that you would use the media as a platform to tell Trayvon's story? Otherwise, might this story just have been swept under the rug?
Absolutely. When Tracy encountered so many problems with trying to get information for a minor from the police department, Sanford Police Department, and then had problems at the medical examiners, we just encountered so many problems in different angles. I decided that I would not go to Sanford. I didn't want to go to Sanford. I didn't want to go to the Orlando area, period. I was just like, you know, let me grieve here. Let me just bring the body back and we'll have a service for him. But when I got a call from Tracy and one of our attorneys, Attorney Crump, said that they were not going to arrest the person that shot and killed. They have the gun. You have the person. You know practically what happened, the scene and everything. Why? And they had no answers. And so that particular night, I packed up my things and I was headed to Sanford. We had a meeting that evening when I got to Sanford, and they were like, listen, they're not going to arrest him. They're not going to arrest him. And we knew then that we could not, you know, have this tragedy swept under the rug, and that we needed to reach out to different media outlets. But let me just say, it wasn't the larger industries that really started the movement. It was the young folks.
Who started the protest, right?
Right. It was the colleges and universities that put things on social media to make the fire start, and that's how it started. And then the cable channels picked it up, and then the bigger channels picked it up. But it was the college students that actually started the movement.
And then there were some prominent figures that helped you get the 911 tapes released.
I think that was due to the pressure that Attorney Crump was applying to the city of Sanford. There really weren't any reason why they should have held the tapes. And the mayor made a conscious decision to release the tapes. And he went against the advice of his constituents.
It was pointed out that Trayvon had a hoodie on, and I don't know why that was made into a big thing, but who organized the Million Hoodie March?
I think it was the grassroots movement, Daniel Marie, and he organized it here in New York. We knew that they were going to have a rally when we came to New York, but we didn't know on what scale. And we walked into when we walked out into Union Square, I think that it took us by surprise.
Were you surprised when President Obama gave his speech?
I wouldn't say I was surprised, because as a father, you just see the compassion and President Barack Obama's personality. And so just knowing that he too was a father, and he felt the compassion of parents, and just to mention Trayvon's name in the White House, it meant a great deal to us.
And then Michael Skolnick comes into the story. Who is he?
Michael Skolnick at the time was an advisor for Russell Simmons. He ran Global Grind, which is a social media network. And Michael Skolnick has definitely been on board with our movement. He's helped us in so many different ways, and he's responsible for really just keeping it in the forefront.
And Black Lives Matter grew out of this?
Black Lives Matter actually, Black Lives Matter actually has their own, it's a different entity, but it did grow from the Trayvon Martin movement.
Are you surprised that Black Lives Matter has become so controversial? So many people cite it in a negative way.
I'm not surprised. People don't quite understand what it's all about. That is not African Americans, or that is not a group of people saying anything negative about another group. What it is saying is, my life matters. It's so many African American men and women that have been killed by senseless gun violence, and have been killed by chokeholds, and have been killed by, strangulation, and just different things that we feel that other people don't feel like our lives matter just as much as theirs matter. And so that's why Black Lives Matter is so important, because we want to bring that particular issue to the forefront, that we matter too.
When you look at the acronym, and there are certainly people that say all lives matter, and we do agree with that. But when we say Black Lives Matter, you have to look at who's getting who has the police brutality issues, or who has the issues with being shot with your hands up or walking away from the police. Those are Black lives that are getting taken away like that. There's no other ethnicity group that's getting taken away like that. So when we say Black Lives Matter, it's our life matters. So don't shoot me when my hands are on the dashboard, or don't shoot me when I'm walking away with my hands up.
My guests are Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin. They have co-authored a book, Rest in Power, A Parent's Story of Love and Justice and Birth of a Movement, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin. It is published by Spiegel and Grau. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Why did you decide to look at Trayvon's call records? How helpful would that have been for your case?
I just think that, as a father, I just wanted to know who was the last person that he was talking to. We know that he was on the phone a lot. I needed to know the last person he talked to, how long he was on the phone, and that kind of gave us a sense of what he was doing at the time of his death. It just dawned on me. It was no particular reason why I looked at my cell phone bill, but I just needed to know who was he talking to at the time of death. What was he doing? And we found answers that were very helpful to us as a family. Because, it started to put a little light on what was going on.
When did George Zimmerman turn himself in? Hadn't he tried to go into hiding?
Yeah, he did go into hiding. He didn't. He never turned himself in. It was after the state attorney decided to file charges against him that he was arrested.
And so, Rita, you wrote that your attorney said the Stand Your Ground law would not be used as a defense. Were you surprised when that changed as the
trial
progressed?
Absolutely, because we had heard that term from the time the situation happened, which was February 2012. We had heard that term, that that's what the defense would be using to stand your ground. And then that was in 2012, and then it wasn't until 2013 that we found out, in April of 2013, that we found out that they would not try to use that as a defense. And so...
it didn't seem to really apply. A boy walking down the street, a man in a car with a gun, he comes out. You would think that Trayvon's case would have...
Absolutely.
He would have been seen as the victim, not as the threat.
Right. I mean, through normal eyes, that would have happened. Trayvon would have been the person that was standing their grounds and not George Zimmerman. But in other people's eyes, you know, people see what they want to see. They perceive what they want to perceive. But at the same time, Trayvon was simply walking back from the store with a drink and some candy. No weapon, not committing any crime.
When George Zimmerman was being cross-examined by Bernie de la Rionda, did you feel, Tracy, that the questions he asked helped your case?
No, I don't think that they asked the right questions. They never asked him what was his motive for even getting out of the vehicle if he felt threatened for his life. If I feel threatened for my life, I'm going to eliminate myself from the equation and not get out the vehicle to see what's going on. And I just had a problem with a person feel that their life was in danger when you get out with a loaded gun.
Sabrina, didn't Judge Kenneth Lester Jr. learn later that George Zimmerman's mother, Shelley, lied about certain information in the court?
No, that was his wife. Shelley was his wife, not his mother.
She perjured herself?
Yes.
So what was that information?
The information was about a passport or some money. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it was about one of the two things that she lied about, and they listened on a videotape, and she committed perjury.
But she was never
punished. Nothing was never done.
And Tracy, you say that 6 weeks later, they replaced the judge. Why did that happen?
Judge Lester was taken off to the case. It had something to do with the prosecutors. They wanted Judge Lester off the case. I personally felt that they saw that Judge Lester was a no-nonsense judge. And they did everything that they could do to get him removed from the case.
So did they feel that the next judge, Deborah Nelson, would help them?
I can't say that they felt that Judge Nelson would help them, but I do feel as though Judge Nelson let them get away with so many different things. I mean, Trayvon was the victim, and he was put on trial. It went so far as... the defense attorney brought in a slab of concrete and said that that was the weapon that Trayvon used. And so I just don't think Judge Lester would have let that. It was a mockery. They made a mockery of Florida law.
Didn't Zimmerman's lawyer, Mark O'Mara, call you up to the witness stand, Sabrina? Why?
Yes.
What evidence could you have given? You weren't a witness.
I have no clue.
What kinds of questions did they ask you?
I don't remember.
They also brought the last person who spoke to Trayvon, Rachel Jaintal, to the witness stand. Did the way she was cross-examined help or hurt the case?
I just think that, and I hate to keep saying this, but the state of Florida, they really weren't prepared. You know that you have a teenage young lady that you're going to put on the stand and that she's going to be cross-examined by experts. And you just don't prepare her for what's in store.
So when did you start to feel that the trial was turning against your son?
In all honesty, we tried to have faith in the judicial system. But from the beginning, we knew that our hands were tied. We knew that when I heard a statement from a potential juror that said that Trayvon would have never been in the situation that he was in had I been involved in his life. I knew that our hands were tied. I knew that these jurors had they already formulated their own opinion about who I was, about who Sabrina was, about who Trayvon was.
Wait. So if you'd been more involved in your son's life, he would have been walking down the street?
Correct.
With a can of soda? Was it soda?
That would, a can of iced tea. But that's the perception that the jurors had. And why
didn't the prosecutors call you to the stand?
I have no idea. We asked several occasions, you know, to call character witnesses. Who best to be a character witness for a deceased minor than his parents?
Sabrina, can you talk about the Trayvon Martin Foundation? Is the program starting to accomplish the goals that you set for it?
Yes, we still are a fairly new organization, but we do have programs that we are very proud of. Most recently, in the next few weeks, on February the 11th, the foundation celebrates Trayvon's birth and not his death. So we know that the media usually celebrates his death, which is at the end of February, but his birthday was February 5th, and so he'll be 22 years old.
And
on February 11th, we have a short walk. It's a what we call a peace walk, and that's exactly what Trayvon was doing. And we let our young people, and we let the world know, we let our local leaders know that you have a right to walk in peace without being followed, chased, profiled, or murdered. And so at the end of that walk is a short distance. At the end of the walk is a peace talk. And at that peace talk, we have our community to come out to speak with our young people, to bridge the gap between law enforcement and our young people. But it's a really awesome event. We ask everybody to come out. It's not just a local event. We ask people from all over the United States to come out and wear the shirt, wear whoever loved one you're supporting, because this is not just about Trayvon. This is about all kids who are victims of senseless gun violence, and even the Trayvon Martins that have not been shot and killed.
Have you found the writing of this book and then talking to people like me and others cathartic in any way? Does this help at all?
I think that it's been therapeutic, but we don't want to get this writing this book as being therapeutic confused with this as being a healing process for us, because it hasn't, because we relive the story so much. This book, as I said, is therapeutic, is very informative. It's for the most part, it's inspirational to those people that have lost loved ones and don't know where to turn, don't know where to go. So this book means a lot to us. And you know, we invested a great deal of time in this book. It's great. It's a great read. And it's just a tribute to who we are and who our son is.
And Sabrina, you've also have created a gathering called the Circle of Mothers.
Circle of Mothers is my signature event. That's an event where I bring mothers from all over the United States, because I understand that we heal differently from fathers. And so I've had Sandra Bland's mom, Eric Garner's mom, Tamar Rice's mom, Mike Brown's mom.
Amadou Diallo.
Yeah, Amadou Diallo's
mom. So you're going
mom,
even back a bit.
Oscar Grant's mom, yeah. Jordan Davis' mom, Dante Hamilton's mom. I mean, I just really bring all of these moms together because I want us to heal together. I want us to empower one another. And then my ultimate goal is for them to go back in their community and help another mother.
I thank you both so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin, Rest in Power, Parents, Story of Love and Justice and the Birth of a Movement, The Enduring Life of Trayvon Martin. It is published by Spiegel and Grau. V Video games have been accused of causing screen addiction and inspiring violent behavior for many years, but as a result of a recent renaissance in video game culture, they're also increasingly being viewed as an innovative art form. In a new book called Power Play, How Video Games Can Save the World, tech journalist Laura Parker and Asi Burak, a video game designer and the chairman of the tech organization Games for Change, look into the impact video games can have on social change, medicine, and education. It's published by St. Martin's Press, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Asi Burak to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Video games have often been blamed for violent behavior in kids in the past. What were the arguments people used to link them to violence?
There is something very intuitive about looking at those violent video games, right? The first-person shooters, and link it to violent behavior. However, we also covered it in the book. Research never proved real link between playing video games and violent behavior. There is some soft evidence for, I would say, being aggressive, but in a very short term after playing a violent game.
And it's obvious that some people who already have inclinations toward violence might be inspired. Others would just see it as a game.
Absolutely.
When did game makers recognize the potential of video games as a tool for positive social change?
I would say that it started something like 12 years ago. And it started very modestly at the beginning. And the quality of those video games was not on par with what you see in the commercial world. But I think now, 2017, 12 years later, you see video games that are super engaging and still have very positive impact on players.
You developed a game called Peacemaker. What's the premise and goal of it?
So that was the first video game I ever made, and it was one of the first examples that got some mainstream attention. It's a game about the Middle East conflict, and it allowed you to view both perspectives. You could play the leader on the Palestinian side, or a very different game playing the Israeli side. And you needed to come into a solution, but the environment is working against you. There's a lot of violence. There's a lot of opposition. So it's a struggle for peace, basically.
So have you ever wondered what would happen if Israeli and Palestinian leaders got together and played this game?
Yeah, I mean, we had some interesting experiences. One of the Israeli candidates for prime minister at that time played on TV, live TV, and he lost after 5 minutes.
And who is playing this game mostly? Is it mostly Israelis or Palestinians?
It is played by both Israelis and Palestinians, but also some Americans. And the Perez Center, the nonprofit of the late Shimon Peres, adapted it as an educational tool.
So people, surprising people, are creating some of these games. New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof and his wife Cheryl Woodun have created the Half Sky movement.
Half the Sky, and Half the Sky is interesting because there is a book, it's a best-selling international best-selling book. There is a documentary, and then they said, you know, we want to make a video game because we want to reach beyond the converted.
And so they created video games, and it also works on a mobile phone?
Yes, so we all together, we helped them to create four games. One on Facebook, which was mostly for people in the West to identify with the causes, and it's women empowerment to donate. But the mobile phone games were actually played in India and Kenya.
So with a women as its ideal audience, do women in developing countries have access to Facebook or mobile phones?
Mostly for mobile phones. Many times it's a shared phone. It might be a shared phone for a family, and they get access to it. And we also implemented it in clinics.
In clinics.
So, for example, there is one game for pregnancy, kind of understanding. It's called 9 minutes. Understanding 9 minutes, the whole cycle of pregnancy. So we put it in clinics, and they played it before the doctor visit.
There's another one that's also involved with medicine called Remission.
Right.
What is that?
Remission is one of the most interesting research cases that we covered because it really proved behavior change. They designed the game for cancer patients, young cancer patients, and they tend to not follow the guidelines sometimes and forget to take their pills. And what Remission does is this amazing connecting the dots moment, and the kids that played it followed the guidelines for 6 months after playing the game.
And that was tested?
Yes, and this is, we're talking about clinical trials testing.
My guest is Asi Burak, who with Laura Parker has written Power Play, How Video Games Can Save the World. How did you and Laura Parker come to collaborate on this book?
So I had this idea to tell the stories and get it into a general awareness, but I'm too busy and I needed some help. And I'm really lucky to find Laura because she's an amazing storyteller. This is what she does. And together, you know, I kind of shared my knowledge and expertise and she wrote it.
Some of the areas you might expect this to work include education. And former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor's gotten involved?
Yes, this is one of the stories that is kind of under the radar, even though it should be known to anyone. 50% of teachers now in social studies across the U.S. are playing the iCivics game in the classes. This is civic education, I think, in the best and in the most engaging way you could think of, you know? Instead of textbooks, why not play video games? Play as the president or play, you know, the court system and understand how the process works.
I'm assuming it adjusts according to the president, as this country has to adjust according to the president.
Yeah, we hope that some things will stay intact, but yeah, we should see. We should see what's going on.
And what kinds of things does it teach about civics?
So it depends. They looked at it as a portfolio. So they built 19 games. And each game attacks a different thing. So there is a game about the Constitution and rights. And the kids needs to differentiate between cases that do have merit and cases that don't. There is a game about debate, you know, debating opinions. So each one of them is covering, but together they create this curriculum.
To some degree, this is similar to what we used to have with board games.
Yeah, I mean, look, board games are games for just like digital games, and they follow many rules. I think they are older, so they have better perception. I hope we'll get the same with video games one day.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the difference is that board games didn't. Well, board games actually began with wars in a way too, because chess and Go
absolutely
are really games about war of a sort.
But in a sense, I think we have a very fond look at board games because we think about playing with the family, you know, and it's a social moment. And I think that video games are getting into that place, but they're not there yet.
Sometimes aren't the claims a little overblown? Last January, studies found that a popular brain game called Luminosity didn't do what the manufacturer was advertising, preventing Alzheimer's.
Yes, I think that this things like that damage our effort. And, you know, the brain science and the neurogaming that we covered, the work of Adam Gazzelli is very different because it comes from the brain science and the people that do it on a daily basis rather than marketers or, you know, people that try to make a quick buck.
There's a game called NeuroRacer.
Yes, and this was on the cover of Nature, which you can't ask for much more. And basically it shows how you can fight mental decline with a video game.
In a way that Luminosity was incapable of doing?
Incapable of doing or proving.
What's the difference?
So the difference is that the guy that came up with this idea for the game is a brain scientist, and he wasn't a video game person. He went to the right people to work with him. And he published before that a lot of papers around mental decline, and he found some of the causes that he could create this video game around. And now he's trying to get FDA approval and get it to be a game that doctors can give their patients.
Otherwise, could people just buy some of these games?
Some of these games are definitely available. In this case, they actually are not getting the game out until they get the FDA approval that they want.
Many popular games encourage competition or conflict. Among the games you have developed, are there any that reward or even require cooperation to win?
Yes, there are games that definitely reward collaboration. Even in Peacemaker, there was a lot about building trust and you know, getting momentum and getting the other side to really acknowledge your good intentions. So, yeah, I mean, as long as you create the right tension, it could be around collaboration as well.
What's crowd gaming?
Crowd gaming is one of the things that surprised me the most. You know, that if you ask 10 years ago, I couldn't imagine that we'll see it, is the idea that a lot of gamers together try to solve something. And it could be something that the real world is trying to solve. In the case we covered, they actually solved a science problem in folding proteins in 10 days, something that science with supercomputers couldn't solve for 10 years.
Because you had a lot of different people.
A lot of different people
contributing.
And creative collaboration.
And has virtual reality been incorporated into the new technologies?
This is very early. You know, we'll have to wait a few years until we all have virtual reality headsets. But what we're seeing is huge potential for empathy. Because of the nature of VR and how immersive it is, and it's almost like in the DNA there is this idea that I'm going to take you to a different place and a different perspective. So it could be a refugee camp in Jordan, right? And you cannot get there any other way but getting there in VR. And it could be live action. It's not necessarily 3D. It could be like the real thing. And you walk around and you look around and you feel like you're in the real place. Your mind believes you're in the real place.
So you experience the things that you could, in a way that you wouldn't if you were just watching a documentary film.
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the projects I've seen recently is Snow World that is being used with army, you know, people that were injured in war. And it actually gets pain reduction. It puts them in this, they have injuries as a result of burns, and they feel they're in a different temperature.
When did you start working for the nonprofit Games for Change, which is usually written as G4C?
Yeah, so I was lucky to start working there in 2010 and running the organization. And I'm saying lucky because it's a very small organization, but it's behind it is a movement and a very big community of people that gather together and work together and trying to advance this movement and getting it out there to the mainstream.
You're funding games of the sort we've been discussing?
Yes, so we help fund challenges and people that get those games, but we also exhibit them and we give them awards. You know, we're trying to be kind of the Sundance of video games.
Is there a way to measure how much impact a game actually has on social change?
Yes. You know, the clearer your targets are, the easier to measure. Like if you have very concrete targets you're trying to achieve, it will be pretty straightforward to measure them in research. But it needs investment for sure.
On the other hand, you, despite the fact that Peacemaker has been popular, you haven't brought peace to the Middle East.
Unfortunately not. And you know, this is one thing I'm saying to people that start in as video game designers. I mean, it has this potential impact and incredible power, but at the same time, keep your expectations in, you know, what is realistic. I mean, you're going to create dialogue, you're going to create understanding, you're going to shift perspectives. You're not going to solve the Middle East conflict.
Well, we've been talking about the games being used for social change, medicine, education. Any other areas you think they might be applied to?
You know, at my real broad look, I would say that they could be applied in anything because at the heart of games are systems. And a good designer is getting a player into exploring a system. The world is full of systems in physics, in politics, in everything around us. And the idea that we are only passively consuming things rather than exploring them is going to change.
Asi Burak, ASIBURAK, was named one of the Digital 25 Leaders in Emerging Entertainment by the Producers Guild of America and Variety Magazine as well for his work with Games for Change. His book, written with journalist, Czech writer Laura Parker, is Power Play: How Video Games Can Save the World. It is published by St. Martin's Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hours after he was inaugurated, President Trump signed an executive order that freezes federal rulemaking pending an administrative review. The order puts at risk an EPA proposal to ban insecticides containing chlorpyrifos, a toxin that scientists say is responsible for a silent pandemic of neurotoxicity. In a report for Intercept titled Poison Fruit, Dow Chemical wants farmers to keep using a pesticide linked to autism and ADHD, Sharon Lerner details how the multinational giant sought to conceal the threat chlorpyrifos poses to human health and to discredit the scientists who have tracked and measured its dangers. Sharon Lerner covers health and the environment at Intercept and is a reporter for the investigative fund at the Nation Institute. She was a National Magazine Award finalist last year for her work on the toxicity of Teflon. And I'm very pleased that Poison Fruit brings Sharon Lerner back to our show. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Hi.
It's hard enough to pronounce, but what is chlorpyrifos?
It's a very widely used pesticide, and it's part of a class of pesticides known as organophosphates. Organophosphates were developed actually first in a Nazi lab in the 1930s. And
by Gerhard Schroeder?
Exactly, by Gerhard Schroeder. And they range in toxicity, but some of them were used as chemical weapons. Sarin is an organophosphate.
What is this neurotoxin designed to do?
Mm-hmm. So it's sold, widely used, to kill pests on crops at this point. Originally, it was first approved in 1965, and originally it was used in homes, like in products like Raid to kill cockroaches and termites and that kind of thing, as well as on crops.
And it targets the nervous system of the insects?
Exactly. Yep.
So I would assume that if it targets the nervous system of an insect, it might also have a similar effect on other animals.
Yes. Well, you're exactly right. And that is part of the problem. And it's something we've known for a long time. That's exactly why these chemicals were used as chemical weapons, because we've known since the 30s that they can affect humans. In particular, chlorpyrifos is designed to interrupt how nerves work. And basically, it kind of turns off some of the receptors and throws bugs and also people, if they get enough of it, into a sort of hyper state, and it can kill, it kills bugs, of course, but it also, in high amounts, can kill people.
And its defenders say, well, we never come into contact with high amounts.
Exactly. And, of course, that's the intention. And, you know, it was registered in 1965, and over the years, the EPA, which oversees such things, has been figuring out what are the acceptable levels to be used. And it has tinkered with that over the years some. And it also, in the year 2000, took the use of these pesticides in homes off the market. It said you can't use them because there were lots and lots of people who were getting poisoned. And so they made a decision at that point to, because of the poisonings, to take it off the market. But they didn't take it off out of agricultural use, in part because Dow threatened to sue the EPA if they did.
Didn't Rachel Carson warn about its use?
Yeah.
It goes back a long time.
Oh,
people
sure.
have known this has had a deleterious effect on people for a long time. If we can't use it at home, why would it be okay to eat things that it's in? They don't spray it.
Well, they spray it and they use it in the ground, both. So there are lots of different applications. But to go back for a second to your point about Rachel Carson, it was sort of heartbreaking. I went back and was rereading Silent Spring when I was writing this piece. And she describes organophosphates exactly as, you know, folks, both Schrader did back, you know, in the 30s, and folks have since, talking about the fact that they affect people as much the same way that that they affect the nervous system of bugs. And she would have been really dismayed to see how it played out, because basically her book, helped ban DDT, and then the sort of decrease in the use of DDT brought about the increase in the use of organophosphates like chlorpyrifos.
It was phased in because DDT was phased out.
In part, yes.
When did the scientific community first notice the specific dangers of them to human health? Didn't Congress ask the National Academy of Sciences to look into whether it is dangerous for children?
Yeah, and that was Bill Landrigan back in the 90s, I believe, was testifying before Congress and did a big report on the impact of pesticides and highlighted both organophosphates and the particular risks posed to children. You know, it was clear for a long time, as I said, about the poisonings. The new information that we've been getting over the past two decades, or last 15 years for sure, is about not the immediate impact, the acute poisoning, but the long-term impacts that come from really low levels. And we've been seeing lasting effects on kids' brains in particular. That's the real worry.
It's been linked to neurological effects, persistent developmental disorders, and autoimmune disorders.
Well, I don't. But not autoimmune. I think autism. Hmm.
And is there a direct link? Do we know for sure? Because autism, the causes of autism,
yes,
continue to be a source,
right,
of great debate.
Yes, autism is a very touchy subject, and rightly so. And a lot of what causes it remains mysterious. But I think we do know that some environmental causes contribute to it and increase the chances. And one of those environmental factors or exposures is chlorpyrifos. And we have a very good, one very, very good study that looked at highly exposed kids in California. And because they have really great data both on autism and on pesticide use in California, they combined those data sets and were able to show that women who lived near fields where it was sprayed while they were pregnant had a much higher increase chance of having a kid with autism later. And for women who lived in those areas during their second trimester, it was more than triple the rate for everybody else.
With that in mind, how many chlorpyrifos, how much of it is used today? How many farms?
So it's, I believe it's 6 million pounds of it, and it's used on 50 crops, used on more than half of apples, lots of broccoli, and just, it is registered for use in 50 crops, and it's used in 100 countries.
My guest is Sharon Lerner, who has written about chlorpyrifos in an article called Poison Fruit, Dow Chemical Wants Farmers to Keep Using a Pesticide Linked to Autism and ADHD. It is available through Intercept?
The Intercept. It's on The Intercept, yeah. And I also have a... Yep.
No, go ahead.
Well, it's not quite out yet, but I think there will be another piece running this weekend.
Chlorpyrifos is manufactured by Dow, as we said. How important is it to the company's bottom line?
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, it's a huge company, of course, Dow. The revenue is $48 billion a year. I don't think this is their biggest product, but it's clearly a profitable, it's a profitable product. And farmers, many farmers like it and say it helps with their bottom line. But I think that whatever the product, if it's, you know, it's companies tend to defend their products and you know, it is certainly profitable.
And on its website, which is chlorpyrifos.com, Dow says that No regulatory authority in the world considers chlorpyrifos a cause of birth defects, and that any link found between chlorpyrifos and developmental neurotoxic effects are due to inherent issues with study design.
Yes. So they have really taken aim at the science. And in particular, there is a study out of Columbia School of Public Health, which looked, which gave some of the best evidence of the neurodevelopmental problems in kids.
That's and by Dr. Virginia Rao.
Virginia Rao, yeah. Rao. So what she did, it was sort of a coincidence, really, that led to her discovery in a way. She had enrolled a bunch of children to look at how various environmental exposures affected them. And in the process of enrolling them, she was looking at chlorpyrifos in their blood. It was banned from home use. I mentioned that it was used to kill roaches, right? And so she had the study population that was split in two, the highly exposed kids, the kids, and then, you know, from before the ban and the kids after the ban who had much lower levels. And she was able to compare the two. And when she did, she found that the more highly exposed kids had higher levels of ADHD. They were more likely to have tremors. They had intelligence, like IQ deficit, memory problems. And she found this at 3 years, I believe at 7 years, and at 11 years. And she is still studying this population. And I believe the oldest of them is now 18. And she has continued to find differences in their brains.
And Dow has dismissed her findings, and they say that a different study, research coming out of the University of California at Berkeley, is good.
Well, I don't know what they say. Did they say that about Berkeley? Well, they have really taken issue with Rao's work, in part because it was a large part of what the EPA relied on when they came up with their decision, their recommendation recently to ban the use of this chemical. But the issue that Dow has raised with her work primarily is, one, that it's not replicatable, which, of course, is not replicatable because you can't recreate the ban of a pesticide. You know, that those were circumstances that just happened. And the other issue that they've repeated often is that she has refused to share her data, the data which is, you know, that she used.
Has she?
No. I mean, I interviewed her about this, and she said, you know, that she had met with the EPA, offered them their her data, and they didn't want it. And when I asked the EPA about this, they referred me to a footnote in one of their papers that basically said the same thing, that initially they asked her for the data, and she didn't provide it for privacy reasons I know from her, but then that after they met, and both Rao and the EPA said that they met and that she answered all their questions, and that because of that, they are no longer seeking the data. And they said that in 2014 and have repeated it since.
Has she offered her data to Dow?
No, I don't think she has. But I think the part of the issue with, there are a number of issues with that. I mean, number one, I believe there are privacy issues in providing people's health information, but I think that part of the problem is that Dow has, you know, a reason to find that it's safe. You know, it's hard to study your own products with, you know, fairly.
I'm speaking with Sharon Lerner, whose latest article is Poison Fruit, Dow Chemical Wants Farmers to Keep Using a Pesticide Linked to Autism and ADHD. You can find a link to that article on our show page at wmyc.org/lopate. And we will continue our conversation after this. We're talking about chlorpyrifos with Sharon Lerner. Her article, Poison Fruit, Dow Chemical Wants Farmers to Keep Using a Pesticide Linked to Autism and ADHD, is well, it could be found in a number of places, Intercept, and also on our show page at wmyc.org, where we have a link to it. Can you tell us a bit about Vicky Herb?
Yeah. Vicky Herb has a terrible story. She is a mother in West Virginia who had a son named Joshua, and I believe he was, I don't remember the year he was born, but I believe it was the early 90s. And he was unintentionally, of course, exposed to a large amount of chlorpyrifos. What happened was he was napping, and apparently they had a regularly scheduled visit with an exterminator who sprayed the windowsill near his crib. And shortly thereafter, he became paralyzed. Vicki Herb and her husband sought the help of an attorney, Stuart Caldwell, who sued Dow on their behalf. And they had a long trial that eventually settled. But it was a really tragic story, and I told it in the story because of that, but also because a lot of stuff came out during the trial that helped us, that illuminated what was going on.
In the discovery phase, yes, of the lawsuit, Vicki's lawyer discovered Dow had over 220 reports of adverse incidents. Aren't they supposed to report them to the EPA?
Yes, they are. And they were fined by the EPA. I don't remember the exact amount, but it was, from the EPA's perspective, a considerable fine. But for a huge company like them, I don't think really they would feel the impact of that.
They attacked the research that showed that chlorpyrifos was bad, promoted their own research, which said that it was good. Aren't their studies performed on animals? Are animal reactions analogous to human reactions?
Well, that is really standard. And industry tests their products on animals because... Well,
but how many animals have autism or ADHD?
Right. No, it is much harder. I mean, and to see, right? We actually have seen in bees and in other animals memory problems and things along the lines of some of the neurodevelopmental problems we see in humans, but certainly you can't see everything in an animal study.
A listener wonders if you peel the fruit, the apple or the pear, does that do away with the pesticide, or is it inside the fruit? Does washing it have any impact?
I think that it's important to wash it, but that it can also be inside the fruit. Yeah.
You discussed Dow's research with Robert Sapolsky, a neuroscientist and Stanford professor. What did he think of it?
Well, Robert Sapolsky was hired by Stuart Caldwell to help with, I don't know if it was the Herb trial or another one. And in the process, Sapolsky took a look at some of Dow's studies on chlorpyrifos. And he told me that, and he told Stuart Caldwell at the time that he found them to be horrible and not well done, full of errors. And he was so appalled by it that he ended up getting a team of neuroscientists, their postdoc researchers, people who had already gotten their PhDs, to review all the science they could find on chlorpyrifos. It took them years, and they did this analysis, which found that all of the studies contained errors, and a great majority of them contained errors that broke the basic laws of science. So he ended up...
89%, he said.
Yeah.
That's more than just a great majority.
Yeah. So he basically said that this is absurd. This is terrible research. And all the errors were in favor, basically led to the conclusion that chlorpyrifos was not dangerous.
Now, you mentioned earlier that in the year 2000, advocacy groups asked the EPA to ban the chemical altogether, but Dow then threatened to sue. Well, can't companies threaten to sue all the time to prevent things from being banned, even if they're harmful?
Yeah, they can, and they do.
And the EPA will back down?
Well, the way I understood it from talking to, and that I learned from a retired toxicologist named Jeremy Blondell, and he was saying, he'd been through numerous lawsuits before, and they're incredibly time-consuming, they're incredibly expensive, they can take years, And I think basically the EPA made a judgment at that time and said, you know, we have this, you know, bird in the hand, a done deal of we can move forward with banning this home use. And it seemed like, you know, that they wouldn't get a fight, or they could try for the whole thing and end up in a big legal battle that might be very expensive. And apparently they went with they went with the home use and let the chemicals stay in on crops.
A listener is wondering how, if you can tell that it's been sprayed on an apple. Should we assume that if we buy organic apples or organic anything, that we're less likely to have chlorpyrifos as in the mix?
I think that it is far less likely. I have seen some reports recently that there are some residues of certain pesticides on organic fruits and vegetables, but obviously, the chance of that, because the principle of organic farming is that you don't use these things, is much less. And I should say that while it's really hard, I don't think we know the quantities yet, how little of this stuff might be dangerous. Every researcher that I talk to emphasize that they eat organic and that they advise particularly pregnant women and parents of young children or young children, basically, to have organic fruit and vegetables if they can.
So this really will probably have less of an impact on my body than it would on a child whose nervous system is just developing.
Yes, and I think it's partly because of their size, and it is partly, as you say, because all this incredible, you know, nerve growth and development connections are being made in the early years. Even when they're in utero, obviously, but it, you know, those first few years are this incredible time of development. And if you just even a tiny, tiny bit of certain chemicals, and chlorpyrifos, I should say, is not the only one.
We've talked about Roundup in the past. Is there any relation between the two?
Well, I mean, there...
That's Monsanto. This is Dow.
Yeah, right. No,
they're the two giants.
Well, and there are others too. But I there is certainly health issues associated with glyphosate or Roundup, but they're different ones. So I would say, I mean, but in terms of the neurodevelopmental toxins, there's really a great report that people can find if they just Google it, called the TENDR statement, which is TENDR statement. And this is from, I don't remember the number, but dozens of doctors and experts in neuro child development that are warning about that there are a number of environmental toxins that lead to these neurodevelopmental problems, and that they believe and present the evidence that this is true, that they're contributing to a rise, particularly in ADHD and autism.
I'm speaking with Sharon Lerner, whose article for Intercept about chlorpyrifos is titled "Poison Fruit, Dow Chemical Wants Farmers to Keep Using a Pesticide Linked to Autism and ADHD." This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What is the CHARGE study?
Right. So the CHARGE study is actually the study I was describing earlier, where they were the folks in California who were kind of using those two data sets, the autism data set and the pesticide data set, and using it to figure out whether the spraying or the use of certain pesticides contributes to an increase in autism cases. And that's, I think, the best evidence we have right now about the connection between, I should say it didn't just find a connection between chlorpyrifos and autism. It found a connection with several other pesticides, some organophosphates and some not.
And so on top of autism, they found insufficient folic intake, an impact on diseases like diabetes, obesity, and hypertension in mothers, and all linked to exposure to pesticides.
No. Those connections actually are with autism. So the folic acid, you know, if you don't get enough folic acid, that can increase your chances of getting autism. And if you have what they're seeing too is the connection between certain diseases like diabetes.
So a ban has been proposed once again, and the comment period has just ended. Who initiated it?
Well, the EPA. So the EPA
Is a response of the fact that Earth Justice sued them?
Well, so there were a number of groups that started suing, that sued the EPA first in 2007 and said, you know, let's get some action on this now. And they sued multiple times. I think it was 2007, 2010, 2012. 2014, and eventually the court that was hearing the case kind of said, enough already, let's get this done. And the EPA agreed to a deadline. It got pushed a couple of times, but they did actually release their final recommendation, and it was...
In November.
It was November, 2 days after the election, and it said, here's the science. It basically updated the science on this issue, and it said, based on the science... some kids were already getting way too much of this stuff, and we propose essentially a ban. We say that it can't be used on any foods anymore. That's what they proposed doing.
But the ban was not imposed, despite the fact that it was apparent that there's going to be a change of administration where attitudes might be a little different.
Well, the thing is, and it's been a very frustrating process to watch, I have to say, it's really down to the wire here, but by law, they need to have a 60-day comment period. And the 60-day comment period ended after Trump, or was it, it ended recently, and now Trump is obviously president, and we have a new administration. And while, it's hard to say exactly what will happen because the EPA's last report was the product of really years of scientific vetting. They had been asked many questions by Dow, by all sorts of people, and they kind of pried apart all the research that it was based on. They combed through it carefully, carefully, again and again. They had several expert panels review it. And these scientists who spent years on this said, you know what, we have resolved our scientific questions. This is settled, and we propose, based on this, a ban. So there really aren't any more steps to be taken in terms of a scientific review. The only thing now is to finalize it, which is sort of like it's
well, how likely is that? Didn't Mike McKenna, a Dow lobbyist, serve on President Trump's transition team? And Myron Ebell, a foe of chemical regulation who's received money from Dow, oversaw the staffing of the new EPA. The president named Dow CEO Andrew Leveris to head the American Manufacturing Council. And let's not forget that Scott Pruitt, President Trump's pick to run the EPA, is a foe of environmental regulation. So does the ban stand a chance?
I don't know. That's the question. And, you know, I can add to that list, which was compiled, a week or two ago, and things are changing so quickly. I saw in public records yesterday that Dow actually contributed $1 million to Trump's inaugural. And on the very first weekday he was in office, he went to a meeting with Andrew Leveris, about cutting regulations. We've seen him cutting, he's the two for one, scrapping two for every one regulation you put forward. He's very clearly anti-regulation and has made a big deal about it. That said, and this is what I think environmentalists are really clinging to and trying to hold on to, is like, I don't think he wants to take on little children. I don't think he wants to stand up and say, I am for something that is going to damage kids' brains. I mean, everybody, people of all stripes have kids, Republicans, Democrats, Breitbart fans, whoever. And, I don't think anybody, if you really sit down and look at this, could think it's a good idea.
Well, we'll know within the next few years, but...
No, we'll know sooner than that. There is a court-ordered deadline of March 31st.
So we'll know in just a couple of months. But can states do something about this?
Well, the only state that really has the infrastructure in place to deal with this is California. They have their own regulatory system for pesticides.
And though New York has, we produce a lot of apples and a lot of broccoli right here in New York.
Yeah. I think that California has the best shot, and they've actually been working on it. But I am hopeful that if this does not happen in March, and I don't know how they would do. I mean, there are several possible paths, but you know, if it doesn't happen in March, then whenever the next administration comes in, it will. but it's, you know, or it will be, you know, I don't know what will happen there. I guess with so much right now, it's like, who knows what's going to happen 2 days, you know. Yesterday we were supposed to see Pruitt, you know, a vote on Pruitt, and Democrats stood up and said, we're not even going to, they boycotted. So.
But that's just a stalling
tactic. That's a stalling tactic.
We're going to wind up with Pruitt in that job.
We'll see. But. But, you know, with this, there are a lot of possible outcomes. And one that I, you know, I'm not naive. I think of myself as, you know, a realist in some ways. But I can see how this could get through. I can see that it is possible.
We will see. March 10th, you said?
31st.
March 31st. Meanwhile, we have a link to Sharon Lerner's article in Intercept on our show page at wnyc.org/lopate. The article is Poison Fruit: Dow Chemical Wants Farmers to Keep Using a Pesticide Linked to Autism and ADHD. Can listeners play any role in getting this ban pushed
yes,
through?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think one of the things that they can... If Dow tries to take the issue of chlorpyrifos to Congress, which is entirely possible, they hired a lobbyist to work on this and kind of do an end run around the EPA. They can call their legislators, and we'll see if that happens. And they can also let the EPA know how they feel. And they, you know, and I think that there was a comment period that just ended. I think that it's, as with everything right now, I think it really does come down to making noise. And so I think it's about legislators, and you can write to the EPA.
And call your legislators in general and say, would you want your kid to be ingesting chlorpyrifos?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the question.
Sharon Lerner, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.